Welcome everyone to the third of our four classes sessions about the four great medieval Jewish Bible commentators, Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, and Ramban. And today's session is about Ibn Ezra. Before I begin, since I know that a lot of the people who are listening to this lecture are in Toronto, and a number of the people who are in Toronto were students at the Bnei Akiva schools in Toronto. I will just mention that today happens to be the yahrzeit of my sister, Brenda Friedman, who I think taught a number of you. And I just wanted to mention her. I'm not going to draw a connection between between my sister Brenda and Ibn Ezra. They were very different personalities. Ibn Ezra was a very cantankerous person, and my sister Brenda was a very warm and loving person and warm and loving teacher. So I just wanted to mention the words of Torah today are dedicated in memory of Brindle Bat Levi Vasara, Brenda Friedman. Abraham Ibn Ezra he's probably the outlier of the group of four Parshanim that we are doing in this series. You'll see his years. There's a bit of controversy about when he was born. It's clear that he was 75 years old when he died. He was the only one of these Parshanim who wasn't a Talmudist, who didn't write a commentary on the Talmud. And later on in this session, I'll talk a little bit about Ibn Ezra's knowledge of Talmud and knowledge of rabbinic literature in general. But Rashi, Rashbam, and Ramban, the other three commentators that we're looking at, probably spent most of their time on Talmudic literature and dealt with the Bible on the side. Ibn Ezra, as I said, was not a Talmudist. He was the only one of the four who grew up in a Muslim country. He grew up in the so-called Golden Age in Spain. I'm sure that most of you know that the name, the Golden Age in Spain, is a little bit of a tendentious name. It was Jews who were trying to argue that it was a good idea to emancipate the Jews of Europe in the 18th, 19th century coined this phrase, the Golden Age in Spain, arguing that at a previous period of history, the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians all got along extremely well in Spain. And there is some truth to this, like all overgeneralizations, there is some truth to the fact that Jews were doing fairly well in Spain until the year 1148. Ibn Ezra, for unclear reasons, left Spain before 1148. 1148 was the end of the Golden Age in Spain, but Ibn Ezra became the Marco Polo of the Jewish world. He moved around the Jewish world, traveling east through North Africa, through Israel, and he says that he reached as far as India. I've no reason not to believe him. And then he came back. Then he came back west. And he wrote most of his books when he lived in Italy and when he lived in northern France. He lived in northern France at the same time that Rashbam lived in northern France. Ibn Ezra was like 10 years younger than Rashbam, and they were both writing commentaries on the Torah, and it's and they were both very interested in pshat, and it seems unusual, but it's likely that they never actually met. There is a description of a correspondence that we have evidence of a correspondence of Abraham Ibn Ezra corresponding with Rashbam's younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam, but we don't have any direct evidence of contact between Rashbam and Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, if he was not a Talmudist, that does not mean that he wasn't an educated person. He was a polymath. He studied everything. He studied philosophy. He studied everything that was out there to study in those days. He was an expert in philosophy. He was an expert in astronomy. He wrote books in these subjects. He was an expert in astrology, which was considered a science by most people who lived in that period. And Ibn Ezra believed in astrology. He said that when the Gemara says "Ein mazal li Yisrael," it means that the astrological signs do not control the Jewish people in the way that they control other people in the world. But he was interested in astrology. He knew Arabic. He was able to read Judeo-Arabic, which gave him knowledge of books that had been written in Hebrew about Hebrew grammar by the great grammarians, Yehuda Chayuz and Yona ibn Janach, and he had this knowledge. They wrote Hebrew grammar books in Arabic, and because he could read Arabic and because he could read Judeo-Arabic, he was acquainted with their works. As I said, he wrote most of his books when he was living in Italy and in northern France, when he was living among Ashkenazim. And he had a certain amount of disdain for the Ashkenazic Jews, and he felt that they weren't sufficiently educated, and he felt that he was bringing the knowledge of Sfarad to Ashkenazic Jews. You see this in a number of passages of his. I'll just start with one passage of his on the verse, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. Ibn Ezra says, Chachamim kiblu shelo yochal Yisrael basar b'chalav. The rabbis received the oral tradition that a Jew should not eat meat and milk. But the question is, what's the connection between not eating meat and milk and the verse that says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk? So Ibn Ezra writes, the Torah generally writes about the most common occurrences. And people don't eat meat, the milk that was cooked together, since it is not a tasty food. I think there might be some people who would disagree with him. I don't have, of course, any opinion on this subject about whether it is or is not a tasty food, but he says that in general, people don't eat it. The problem with eating meat and milk cooked together is that it takes a long time to cook meat and it takes a short time to cook milk. And so it doesn't work out very well when you cook them together. And that's why you can never find in Muslim countries today people eating a goat that was cooked with milk. But I'll just, to save time, I'll just read the continuation of it only in the English, but those of you who can look at the Hebrew in the slide. But since the meat of a kid, a baby goat, isn't moist, they do cook a kid in milk. So in other words, while cooking meat and milk together is something that people wouldn't normally do, I know from my knowledge of what goes on in Muslim countries that that's one form of cooking meat and milk together, which is a popular way of doing this. And then he turns to his Ashkenazic audience here and says to them, don't be surprised. I know that no one in these countries eats kids. Nobody eats baby goats in this country. But all the doctors say that there is no meat as good as it is, and they even allow sick people to eat it. And today, people eat baby goats in Spain, in North Africa, in the land of Israel, in Persia, and in Babylonia, and our ancestors used to eat it. So you Ashkenazim don't understand this because you don't eat baby goats. I saw somebody tried to raise a hand. It's probably better if someone writes a comment in the chat than raising a hand. Okay, so I see that there are some comments here in the chat, but no questions yet. If somebody has a question to ask, it'd be better to ask it in the chat. Okay, so this is one comment of his that shows that he's not enamored by the Jews of Ashkenaz, but that he feels that he can teach them a little bit about how the world works and how how his knowledge of the world helps us understand the Torah better. We see stronger things that he wrote about Ashkenazic Jews. In one of his grammar books, he wrote a number of grammar books. In Sefer Safa Brura, he writes, "Ein safek shehem," meaning Chazal, the rabbis, "yadu haderach hayishara kasher hi." Without doubt, the Talmudic rabbis knew the straightforward interpretation of the biblical text. And that's why they formulated the rule that a verse never departs from its pshat, plain meaning. We saw Rashbam quoting that line also last week in order to explain why he was interested in pshat, because ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. Rashbam actually said that the rabbis realized this, but they didn't attune themselves to pshat because they realized that the most important level of meaning of the text was the midrashic level of meaning of the text, and that's why I'm writing my commentary, because they didn't know pshat. And Ibn Ezra says, no, of course they knew the pshat. Hadrash hu tosefet ta'am. When they offer a midrash, it's just, you know, an added level of meaning. But then he makes this comment assessing what he sees as going on, particularly in Ashkenazic countries. He writes, Hadorot haba'im samu kol drash ikar v'shoresh kerav Shlomo zal. Later generations made midrash the center and essence of their study. For example, Rabbi Solomon, Rabbi Shlomo Rashi. And what does he say about him? Sheperasha Tanakh al derech drash, v'hu choshev kihu al derech pshat, v'ein bisfarav rak pshat echad mini elef, v'chachmei dorenu yitalalu be'ele hasefarim. Rabbi Solomon wrote a midrashic commentary on Tanakh. He thought that he was writing pshat, and in his books, though, one comment in 1,000 is pshat. This is quite an insult to Rashi, saying that Rashi, while Rashi claimed to be writing pshat, 1 in 1,000 times he actually wrote the pshat. And these days, people love books like this. This is unhappy Ibn Ezra, complaining about the way people relate to the Bible and feeling that he has a better way of relating to the Bible. I mentioned that we have no evidence of any contact between Rashbam and Ibn Ezra, but it seems that late in life, at least, Ibn Ezra learned something about Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. On the verse in Parshat Lech Lecha, Va'avarcha mevarechecha u'mekalelcha aor, I will bless those who bless you, I will curse those who curse you. V'nivrechu v'cha kol mishpechot ha'adzama. Normally we translate that as, all of the families of the earth will be blessed through you, v'nivrechu. But Rashbam wrote in his commentary, you have it there, at the top of the slide, Rashbam wrote in his commentary, as we know, Rashbam's commentary, as we mentioned last week, Rashbam's commentary on the beginning chapters of Bereishit was lost, including the commentary on this verse, but the phrase appears later on in chapter 28 of Bereishit, and Rashbam writes, the Nivrechu Lashon Mavrich Umarkiv, Klomar yitarvu b'mishpachtecha kol mishpachot ha'adama Shari Mishkal Rafehu Kvar Perashtiv BeParshat Lech Lecha. So he says, I already explained this back in Parshat Lech Lecha in the missing section of his commentary, but I mentioned last week Hillel Nevetsky's wonderful work of trying to reconstruct Rashbam's commentary on the last chapters. You can find on the earliest chapters of Bereishit. You can find this at his website, alhatorah.org. You can find his attempt to reconstruct what Rashbam wrote in Lech Lecha. But here we find about the same phrase. Rashbam says, v'nivrchu doesn't mean they will be blessed, but it will mean they will be grafted, they will be engrafted into all of the nations of the world will join in or have the potential of joining with the Jewish people. In other words, all the families of the earth will become intermixed with your family. And then Rashbam gives a grammatical argument. For those of you who like Hebrew grammar, to do one grammatical point here today. He says, the Nivrahu couldn't be the passive form of to bless, because it is an undagashized construction, because it's a nifal and it isn't a pu'al. Because the verb to bless in Hebrew, levarech, is in piel. And so the passive form of levarech should be in pu'al. But this isn't in pu'al, it's in nifal. And so Rashbam says, okay, so this is a proof that it couldn't mean to be blessed, so it must mean something else. So he looks in rabbinic literature and he finds the verb lahavrich, which means to engraft. And so he comes up with this explanation, to which Ibn Ezra says in a commentary that he began late in life called his Shita Acheret. In the last years of his life, he started another commentary on Bereishit, and only small sections of that commentary survived, and you can find them in the Mikraot Gedolot that was published by HaKeter, affiliated with Bar Ilan University. Ibn Ezra wrote in his commentary, Chacham Gadol Amar B'Sifro Ki V'Nivruchu V'Cham Migizrat Havrachat HaIlan. One great scholar wrote in his book that the word V'Nivruchu here is relating to the grafting of trees. And he writes, Lo yadati hi mi hevio batzara hazot. I have no idea who forced him into this dreadful explanation. Yes. And somebody writes, Susanna writes, it's nifal. If it's connected to lahavrich, it should be hufal. Presumably, that is what Ibn Ezra says when he does not like this explanation. So if you have problems with this explanation, Ibn Ezra has problems with it also. And it does seem that that the verb Beit Resh Kaf in Hebrew is an exception. The although I'm such a, as many of you know, I'm a big fan of Rashbam, I don't think this is one of his most convincing explanations, and it is likely that Benivrahu here is the passive of Levarech, even though it's a Nifal instead of being a Pu'al. Okay, for those of you who don't like Hebrew grammar, I think that was the last Hebrew grammar comment of today, and we'll go on. Okay, so that's one of the characteristics of Ibn Ezra is he was an unhappy Sephardi living in Ashkenazic countries and trying to bring some of the Torah of Sfarad to Ashkenaz. I'll just mention a novel that I truly love, Aleph Bet Yehoshua's novel, Masa El Tom HaElef, The Journey to the End of the Millennium, which took the action in the novel takes place around the year 1000. And it's a story about Ashkenazi-Sephardi tensions 1,000 years ago, when the Sephardim were the ones who saw themselves as being the cultured people and the educated people, and the Ashkenazim were not. Somebody asked me to send source sheets. I'm not going to be able to write down your email address during the session here, but if you send me an email to Lockshin, Lockshin, at yorku.ca, I will send source sheets. They're also found on the website of Torah in Motion. But I'm happy to share the source sheets to for anybody who writes me, or anybody who wants to ask any question and discuss anything afterwards. Please feel free to write me. Okay, so Ibn Ezra is also famous in many circles for being what some people claim is a proto-biblical critic, of expressing some surprising ideas about the authorship of the Torah text. And we'll look at the classical example here. I'm sure a number of you have studied this before, but perhaps not everybody. The verse, again, at the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha, when it says that Vayavor Avram ba'aretz ad mekom Shechem ad Elon Moreh v'hakna'ani az ba'aretz. Abram passed through the land, and he came to Shechem, and the Canaanites were then in the land. So the implication of the Canaanites were then in the land is a difficult phrase, because generally if I say I went to Rishon LeZion yesterday, my aunt Tilly, I went to Rishon LeZion 5 years ago, then my aunt Tilly lived in Rishon LeZion. So she lived in Rishon LeZion, the people who are listening to that think that that implies that Aunt Tilly doesn't live in Rishon LeZion anymore. If I say then she lived there, it sounds like she doesn't live there anymore. And so if it says here, if the author of the Torah writes here, the Canaanites lived in the land there, Haknani az ba'aretz, that implies that at the time that the author is writing this verse, there weren't any Canaanites in the land. And so if we want to say that Moshe was writing the Torah before the Jewish people captured Eretz Yisrael, why would he write in the Torah the Canaanites were then in the land? Ibn Ezra was not the first person to realize the problematic nature of this verse. Rashi definitely did. So Rashi writes here, the Canaanites were then in the land. I'll read it in English just to save time. They, the Canaanites, were gradually conquering the land of Israel from the descendants of Shem, for it had fallen to the share of Shem when Noah apportioned the earth amongst his sons. For it is said of Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, which is Jerusalem, and Melchizedek is seen as being Shem, according to the Midrash. For this reason, the Lord said to Avram, to your seed will I give this land. In some future time, I will return it to your children, who are descendants of Shem. So Rashi constructs this history that the land of Israel used to belong to, in the beginning it belonged to the Semites, and then it was captured by the Canaanites, and then the Jewish people, the Semites, came back and recaptured the land. And so Rashi says that when it says here, the Canaanites were then in the land, it means that we're not in the oldest period of history, which was when the land of Israel belonged to the Semites. It was in that middle period. There was the period of the Semites, then the Canaanites, and then the Semites again. And this was in the period the Canaanites were then in the land, is the meaning of this text. So this assumes that the land of Israel originally belonged to the Semites. Some of you might realize that this might not go all that well with what Rashi also said, that in his first comment on Sefer Bereishit that we saw 2 weeks ago, when he said that, you know, the reason that the whole story of Bereishit is told is because some people might think that we Jews captured Eretz Yisrael when it doesn't belong to us, and that's why the Torah teaches us that the whole world belongs to God, and he gives it to one people, and then he can take it away from that people, and he can give it to another people. So that Midrash and this Midrash don't totally flow together. And in fact, Rashi's most famous super commentator, Mizrahi writes about this. Agadot Chalukot. Apparently, these midrash disagree with each other, and Rashi will sometimes quote midrashim that do not agree with each other. But be that as it may, that's how Rashi manages to solve here the problem of the alleged anachronism here I'm just looking at a comment here on the chat. Rashbam says that Rashi didn't write a pshat commentary very, very well, but he will. And now Ibn Ezra says that Rashbam didn't write a pshat commentary, and he will. 100%. That's right. That's what everybody is doing here. Rashi says he's going to write pshat. Along comes Rashbam. Yes, sorry. Okay. So that's how Rashi solved this problem. What did Ibn Ezra say about this problem of the Canaanites were then in the land? He writes, so he's heard of the answer that Rashi gave, either from Rashi or from some other source. And he says, Yitachen she'eretz Kanan tefasa Kanan miyad acher. Maybe it was the case that Canaan captured the land of Canaan from some other people. And then the Canaanites were then in the land means they had already, it's like they had already captured the land. And then he says, and if that is not the case, there's a secret here. Ibn Ezra loves secrets, loves saying there's a secret here, and I'm not going to tell you, and you're going to figure it out on your own. V'hamaskil yavin v'yidom, according to some texts and according to other texts, v'hamaskil yidom, the person who is wise should understand and be quiet. If you have figured out what the secret is here, then you should not tell anybody. So in the 17th century, Spinoza famously wrote that he came to understand that Moses could not have been the author of the entire Torah from studying Ibn Ezra's commentary. And I said that he famously did it. He wasn't the first person to do it. In the 13th century already, a rabbi named Rav Yosef Tuv Elam, who wrote a super commentary on Ibn Ezra, said, that's the meaning of what Ibn Ezra is saying, that Moses could not have written these words because these words imply that they were written at a time when they were written at a time when the Canaanites were not in the land, and that's because the Jewish people had already captured the land from the Canaanites. So Ibn Ezra, I'm pretty convinced that from this passage and from some other passages of Ibn Ezra that we won't go in here too, that Ibn Ezra had a different viewpoint about the authorship of the Torah than Rambam's viewpoint about the authorship of the Torah. And of course, Ibn Ezra lived before Rambam, and that Ibn Ezra felt apparently that there could have been additions to the Torah after the days of Moshe, just as the Gemara records an opinion that the last 8 verses in the Torah were written by somebody other than Moshe, the verses that describe the death of Moshe. So also Ibn Ezra says that there are other verses. Rav Yosef Tuv Elam, who was the first person who said it explicitly, that that's what Ibn Ezra is saying, said, so what? What difference does that make? If it's prophecy, if it's the word of God, what difference does it make if the words were written a little bit later? So this is perhaps a surprising attitude of Ibn Ezra here, but we notice that Ibn Ezra also disagrees with people who express this same kind of attitude. Another verse that gives people a lot of problems when talking about seeing Moshe as the author of the entire Torah is the verse, Ela ha-malachim asher malchu be'eretz Edom lifnei meloch melech livnei Yisrael. A list in chapter 36 of Bereishit of kings who ruled in Edom before there were any kings for Bnei Israel, but there weren't any kings for Bnei Israel until many, many years after Moshe. So how could Moshe write this? And so some people will say Moshe wrote this through prophecy, fine. Or other people say that Moshe was the first king of the Jewish people, and this means before Moshe was the king. Ibn Ezra writes, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. Some say that this passage was written through prophecy. Yitzhaki wrote in his book, Ibn Ezra often quotes this man called Yitzhaki, and scholars are not sure who this is. Whatever work this is that he's quoting did not survive. And curiously, Ibn Ezra quotes many works that did not survive. And the only reason that we know about these works is because Ibn Ezra quoted them in order to argue against them. So Ibn Ezra did not like this work written by Yitzhaki. And the only way we know about it is from quotations. Ibn Ezra also quoted frequently, we'll say a little bit more about this later on in the session, often quoted from Karaite works that totally got lost and that we know about now only through quotations in Ibn Ezra. Yitzhaki wrote in his book that this passage was written in the days of King Yehoshaphat. So he solved the problem by saying that this was written in the day of the kings. About this, Ibn Ezra says, correctly, his name is called Yitzhaki. Whoever hears such an interpretation would laugh at him. Kol hachi kara shemo Yitzhak, kol hashomea Yitzhak lo. This is laughable to give an interpretation like this. God forbid that we interpret that the passage refers to the days of Yehoshaphat. His book ought to be burned. This is not the only time in Ibn Ezra's Torah commentary where he advocates burning a book that he did not like. And so why would Ibn Ezra feel okay in offering this, we might say, heterodox interpretation of the authorship of the Canaanites who were then in the land, but he doesn't feel good about offering a heterodox interpretation of the authorship of this passage? I don't know. And sometimes the answer is that people who have heterodox opinions think, my heterodoxy is okay. Everybody else's heterodoxy isn't okay. It's okay if I want to go against the standard understanding of tradition, but I don't want somebody else to do it. Two comments that came in the chat: did Ibn Ezra hold pantheistic views like Spinoza would have liked? No. Spinoza is pretending really to be depending on Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra is a tiny section of Spinoza's thought. Another comment, wasn't some of Ibn Ezra written in Atbash code in order to keep it secret from ordinary readers? Actually, Rashbam did that one time, writing in Atbash code in order to disguise one of his points, which is not the best code to use because it's too easy to break. Yes. And another comment here, maybe the level of heterodoxy is different if we say that it was Joshua and not centuries later. Yes, that could very well be. That's a possibility about why Ibn Ezra does not like this heterodox interpretation of Genesis 36. Okay. How did Ibn Ezra generally understand the phenomenon of prophecy and of revelation? A telling passage of Ibn Ezra can be found in another grammatical work of his called Sefer Sfat Yeter. This whole book is a book dedicated to disagreements between Rav Sadia Gaon and Donash Ibn Labrat about grammatical issues. And in the middle of this detailed grammatical book, Ibn Ezra has a dispute between Sa'adia Gaon and Donash ibn Labrat about revelation. How does revelation work? Again, I'll read it just in English, and those of you who want can follow the Hebrew. Rabbi Sa'adia Gaon once wrote that the prophet Isaiah has a pleasant, elegant style. Rabbi Donash ibn Labrat disagreed and said that this is a mistake. All words of prophecy are from God. So we can't say that one prophet is better than another one. If prophets are passing on the word of God, it doesn't make any sense to say that Sa'adia Gaon had better style than some other prophet. And then Ibn Ezra says, but it is Rabbi Donash who is mistaken. Actually, Sa'adia Gaon is right. Throughout most of Sfat Yetzer, this book is to say that Sa'adia Gaon's theories of grammar were better than Donash ibn Labrat's theories of grammar. But now he's saying that Donash's understanding of revelation is not as sophisticated and is not as correct as Sa'adia's understanding of revelation. The text here is a little garbled, but printed edition of Sfat Yetzer, but anyways, I'll read it here in the English translation. The meaning of the words can be seen to be like spirits and ideas that God places in the soul of the prophet. The prophet then puts those ideas together according to his skills and the abilities that God gave him and according to his inborn qualities. But that's not what this book is about. Oh, I forgot. I'm supposed to be writing a grammar book. Let's get back to grammatical issues. But along the way, he says, how does prophecy work? And he says this in other works of his also. Prophecy works, and ideas come into the mind of the prophet, and then the prophet puts those ideas into words using the skills that he has, his God-given skills and inborn qualities. And so it's quite fine to say that one prophet has a better style than another prophet, because there's a human element in prophecy. The ideas come from God, but the words come from the prophet himself. There was a question here asking if I could say something about Ibn Ezra writing more than one commentary on a book. When he was in Italy, he wrote a full commentary on the Torah. Later on, when he came to France, he started a project of writing about the Torah again, and he completed the commentary on Shmot, and in the standard Mikraot Gedolot that we have, for some reason, I guess it is a logical reason, we have the commentary that he wrote on Bereshit, Vayikra, the Midbar, and Devarim in his Italy version, but we have the later, we don't have the commentary that he wrote on Shmot when he was in Italy. It wasn't printed in the standard Mikraot Gedolot. We had his second edition, his longer edition that he wrote when he was living in France. And in some current editions of Mikraot Gedolot, you can find both the older commentary, the shorter commentary that he wrote when he was in Italy, and the later, longer commentary that he wrote when he was in France. Okay, so that's Ibn Ezra in general about revelation, and arguing that revelation does involve some action from the person receiving the revelation. And in this, the next series of texts are going to talk about, they're going to focus on Ibn Ezra's understanding of the interplay of philosophy and religion. Ibn Ezra, according to some historians, Ibn Ezra married Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's daughter. This may be the case. We know that they knew each other. We know that they considered themselves to be mishpacha. Was he actually Yehuda HaLevi's son-in-law? Maybe not. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, may he rest in peace, once asked me, why do the Ten Commandments, why does the Decalogue say, I, the Lord, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt? Why doesn't it say, I am the God who created heaven and earth and created you? And here follows my answer to him. Some of you might recall that in the Kuzari, in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's famous work of philosophy, the Khazar king asked the Jewish spokesman, says to him, boy, you said something really stupid by starting by saying that God is the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Why don't you say that God is the one who created heaven and earth? That's how a normal religious person would begin his explanation of about his religion. Why didn't you begin by describing God as being the creator? And then in the Kuzari, Judah HaLevi gives an answer to that question. And he says, and this also explains why God began the Ten Commandments with, I am God who took you out of Egypt, instead of beginning with, I am the God who created heaven and earth. Ibn Ezra is saying that Judah HaLevi once asked him this question, and here's my answer to him, which is not the same answer that Yehuda HaLevi writes in the Kuzari, but this is Ibn Ezra's answer to Yehuda HaLevi. No, that people have beliefs in God that are at different levels from each other. Many believe whatever they heard, whatever their master told them. You know, your teacher told you you're supposed to believe in God. Your father told you, if you're a slave, your slave owner told you, whoever's in charge of you told you what it is that you're supposed to believe, and that's what you believe. At a higher level are those who believe what is written in the Torah that God gave to Moshe. So there are some people who just believe what their teacher told them. There are others who formulate their beliefs based on what they read in the Torah. But of a heretic came to challenge them and said, there is no God, they just cover their mouth with their hands. They wouldn't know what to answer. So you say, why do you believe that? And you say, because it's written in the Torah. And they say, but there is no God and there is no revelation. Then they wouldn't know what to answer. So those are two lower forms of belief. But Ibn Ezra says, however, people whose spirit moves them to learn sciences will come to know about God's work by studying metals, plants, animals, and the human body itself. And like a good student of medieval philosophy, Ibn Ezra believes that if you study the world, if you study the physics, you study the biology of the world, then you will eventually come to understand the world and to understand God, and then you will come to the study of the metaphysics, that which is behind the physics, the philosophy that is behind the text. And then they ascend to the study of the spheres. Then they begin to study the world of the spheres, a term from Aristotelian philosophy, and then which also for Ibn Ezra means studying of astronomy, and then they will know when the sun or the moon is going to be eclipsed. These are all the things that an educated person should educate himself or herself about the world around them and understand it. And by knowing God's actions, the wise person then knows God. Now, if you study the world sufficiently and you understand science sufficiently, you will come to know God and to understand God. And so, accordingly, for the wise person from any nation, the words, I am the Lord, suffice. You don't have to say anything more, because the wise person who has studied science and has studied philosophy knows that there has to be a God. And I am the Lord would suffice. However, Ibn Ezra goes on in this comment, in order to become their deity, God performed signs and miracles for the Israelites in Egypt that allowed Moses to free them. Because of the miracles done by God in Egypt, Moses was able to say, "It has been clearly demonstrated to you that the Lord alone is God, since everyone, the learned and the unlearned, the great and the small, all saw these miracles." So what's good about miracles is that miracles work for everybody, for the learned and the unlearned, the great and the small. And that's why Moshe was able to turn to the Jewish people and say, it's been proven to you that God is there through these miracles. And then Ibn Ezra says, accordingly, the Decalogue says, "I am the Lord, Anochi Hashem," addressing the learned person. Because the learned person knows that there has to be God, because the person who studied sciences sufficiently realizes that there has to be God. And so if God was just speaking to the learned, he would have said, "Anochi Hashem." That's all that he would have had to say, is that "I am the Lord." But then why does it say after that, "who took you out of Egypt?" And then it adds, "who took you out of Egypt," so that both the learned and the unlearned would understand. Another question that came in: does Ibn Ezra perhaps create interlocutors like the Sadducees who he claims to have debated? It's possible. But when Ibn Ezra talks about Sadducees, that's his code word for Karaites. And he wasn't the only medieval writer who used the word Tzadokim to describe the Karaites. In fact, a number of the Karaites, for those of you who don't know, Karaites were Jews who lived in this period only in Muslim countries. And so Ibn Ezra knew about them from the time that he spent growing up and living in Muslim countries. The Karaites are Jews who don't believe in the Talmudic traditions. And Ibn Ezra is constantly debating with them. And I think that they are real. It's always possible that any writer might create a straw man argument of somebody who offers an interpretation that wasn't actually offered anywhere. But I think that Ibn Ezra was, for the most part, if not all the time, arguing against interpretations that really were out there, even if they didn't survive until today. So this brings us here to a difficult question about Ibn Ezra's loyalty to the halakha. It's not actually all that difficult to say that Ibn Ezra was loyal to halakha. He says it all the time. He says all the time, and I believe him, that he's loyal to the rabbinic tradition. You know, I looked to find examples from this week's Parshat HaShavua, from the Torah portion for this week, and I found actually four different times in the commentary on Bahar B'chukotai that he says, you know, we need the interpretation of the rabbis. I just gave you two of them here. V'hinei anachnu tzrichim l'kabbalah al shana tmima, im l'chama, im l'levana, v'im uberet. That in the rules about buying a house in a walled city, it says that the house can be redeemed ad melot shana tmima, until a complete year has passed. But it doesn't define what a complete year is. And so Ibn Ezra uses this as an opportunity to say that, of course, we need to have an oral tradition. There has to be a Torah Sheba'al Peh, because the Torah uses the term Shana Tmima. It doesn't define what a year is. We don't know whether it's a solar year or a lunar year. And what happens if there's a lunar leap year? Would this law apply for 12 months, or would it apply for 13 months? And that's why we need the Talmudic tradition in order for us to know the proper interpretation of a biblical text. Another example from this week's parsha, in talking about a non-Jewish slave, of course, a Jewish slave, we already learned in Parshat Mishpatim, goes free after 6 years, but it says about a non-Jewish slave, it says, La'olam bahem ta'avodu, and Ibn Ezra says about that, mutarim, meaning it's permitted to work to enslave to keep this person in your service forever. You don't have to free him like you free a Jewish slave. And then he says, "Rak kasher matzanu chazal she'amru ki hi mitzvah kibalnuha." But you know, I found out that the rabbis, I learned that the rabbis say that actually that it's obligatory. It's a mitzvah. The Talmud says that a person who frees a non-Jewish slave has transgressed this mitzvah that says la'olam bahem ta'avodu. The Gemara has various exceptions to this, but here we're just dealing with the question of how to interpret this text. Is this permission to keep a slave beyond 6 years, or is it an obligation? Ibn Ezra says, keep al nuha. We accept what they had to say. You know, okay, I told you what the pshat is. I told you what the pshat is. But I accept rabbinic tradition. And he often says this, that he accepts rabbinic tradition, that he retreats from an interpretation. Last week, I showed you Rashbam's interpretation that said that the pshat is that a Kohen doesn't go to his wife's funeral. And Ibn Ezra on that passage says, you could have thought that that's what the verse said. But once I saw that Chazal said that a Kohen does go to his wife's funeral, he says, Batel HaPerush HaRishon. The first interpretation is canceled. I'm loyal to rabbinic tradition, and I cancel that first interpretation. There was a question that came in the chat about possible influences of Ibn Ezra on Rashbam. I'm very doubtful that there were any influences of Ibn Ezra on Rashbam, but if you'd like to ask me more about that in an email afterwards, I'll be happy to talk about that. However, the problem is that Ibn Ezra doesn't always seem to be following rabbinic tradition, and he writes a number of things in his commentary that don't go along all that well with rabbinic tradition. For example, he writes, a ger who still observes his own religion, ger shehu al dato v'hu ger sha'ar. A ger sha'ar, it's a Talmudic term, but for a ger toshav, that means somebody who lives in your gate, but he hasn't converted. We're not talking about a convert. We're talking about a Gentile who lives in a place with Jewish jurisdiction, lives in your land on condition that he observes Shabbat. The condition for a non-Jew living in among Jews is that the non-Jew has to observe Shabbat. And the Talmudists in the crowd here will know that the Talmud says the precise opposite and says that a non-Jew is not allowed to observe Shabbat. In fact, people who are going through Orthodox conversion process and are told, you know, to start practicing the mitzvot, but they are told that they shouldn't observe Shabbat fully until they convert to Judaism, because Shabbat is something special for the Jewish people. Ibn Ezra writes about the verse, Habachor asher teled yakum al shem achiv hamet, he writes, the firstborn that she gives birth to should be named after the deceased brother. In the case of Yibum, in the case of levirate marriage, that you name the child. And the Talmud says that, it mentions that interpretation or rejects that interpretation. That could not be the interpretation of the text. And Ibn Ezra says that is the interpretation of the text. Ibn Ezra writes, I searched through the Torah and I found 23 examples of infractions that are punished with karet. Well, People who have studied the Talmud know that there's a Masechet called Kritut, and that the first Mishnah in Kritut tells you that there are 36 infractions for which you get karet. This leads to the difficult question of how much did Ibn Ezra know of the Talmudic tradition? I once discussed this question with Professor Uriel Simon here in here in Jerusalem, who is perhaps the world expert on Ibn Ezra. And he said to me that he figures that Ibn Ezra had an excellent Sephardic education, which did not include much of the Babylonian Talmud, and that in Sephardic circles in these days, the good education that a Jew received was studying the kind of condensed form of the Talmud that's found in Rav Yitzchak Alfasi's Halachot, and that he probably knew Rav Yitzchak Alfasi's Halachot, but Rav Yitzchak Alfasi's, the Rif's Halachot, do not include any of the proofs from biblical texts. And so it's hard to say that he strays from Halacha. It just might be that he doesn't know that he is saying something different from the Talmudic tradition because he is not an expert in the Talmudic tradition. I'm saying something that might be a little controversial. Perhaps some people would disagree with me about this, but I will say it anyways. I'm going to skip some of these and just go to the last text here and finish off here with, I think, a crucial point about Ibn Ezra's understanding of biblical interpretation, which again comes from a grammar book of his. In a passage where he's making fun of people who have ideas about biblical interpretation that he doesn't like, he says, he talks about a person who says, this verse has 10 different meanings. I can offer you 10 different interpretations of this verse. He's so proud of himself. He's making fun of somebody like this who says, I can offer you 10 different explanations of this verse. And when people hear about this, his reputation as an exegete rises. They say, oh, he came up with 10 interpretations of that verse. That's wonderful. And then Ibn Ezra says, but the opposite is true. For when he offers 10 explanations for a verse, he has no idea which one is true. In fact, the correct explanation might not even be included. So offering 10 interpretations of a verse doesn't serve any purpose because, as he concludes this passage, for there is ki kol mechaber sefer, navi haya o chacham, ta'am echad lidvarav. For there is only one correct explanation for the words of any author, whether he be a prophet or a sage. And while Rashi and Rashbam and Ramban, certainly, who we'll see next week, were very comfortable with the idea that, of saying that there is a multivalent text, that there is a text that has more than one way of understanding it, Ibn Ezra insists that there is one correct way of understanding any text. And that's why when he knows that an interpretation that he is giving is going against rabbinic tradition, he says, okay, I cancel that. I'm giving in because there can only be one correct interpretation for this. You can't say that on the pshat level, this is reshut, and on the midrash level, it's chovah. There can only be one interpretation of any text. This is a very limiting understanding of the interpretation of text and a very limiting understanding of pshat. Just take a last look at the chat here. Was the Talmud Bavli always considered the halacha? Certainly not. But there are in the Babylonian Talmud interpretations of texts that are the common interpretation of the text. Someone asks, okay, if even Ezra says, I'm accepting the rabbinic tradition, why didn't he erase or cross out the earlier explanation? A wonderful question. I wonder about that all the time. Is he hinting that that he does? Is he wink, wink hinting that he does still like that interpretation, even though he didn't, he said that he didn't? Some critics say this. Okay, I'm going to unmute people if I can figure out how to do it, and wish you all the best and happy Lag BaOmer to all of you. And, wonderful seeing you all, and look forward to seeing you.
You want to come in?